Welcome to Jewish Boy Calls Your Mother. I'm your host, Sadia, and this is my mother, Ima. Hey, Ima.
Hey, the sweetness. Man,
That...
am I as ugly as I look on this video?
No, it's just it's the screening, it's the lighting, it's also the we're using like, you're using your iPhone camera, so it's not gonna be and you have like how old's your iPhone?
Oh my gosh.
10 years old?
You know what? I think I needed a new one when I was visiting. I think when I was helping Pesci in New York with one of her kids when she was in Brooklyn.
Oh wow,
When
so basically
she was in
10
Brooklyn.
years
So, oh
ago.
my gosh, this
So
must be really old man.
you have a really old phone as well.
Yeah.
So
Old woman, old phone. Hey, I guess
oh,
we
don't
end
put
up
yourself
getting
down. You're fine. You're as spry as anyone else.
that. It's so funny
So
when I work with some of my music students, my violin and piano students, like, I'm too tired. Yeah. I go, and these are kids, these are like 9, 10 year old kids. And I said, oh, come on, old woman or old man. Come on, you gotta be young and spry like me. Get some energy.
oh yeah, for sure, 100%. So we were going to talk about a little bit about Pesach cleaning, and then take it from there.
We're talking about there are many ideas that came in my head about the things I was reminiscing about. And I remember, first of all, remember years ago that you could only use the Pesach soaps, the ones with certified kosher to Pesach, and those were horrible. They didn't clean well. The dish liquids didn't wash dishes well. And oh my gosh. And then later on, they came out with a list of those commercial products that you could use that don't contain anything that would be objectionable for Pesach. And now the latest thing is that most things, like most toiletries and deodorants now, like deodorants in general, you can use as long as it doesn't contain oatmeal or something like that, or wheat. But and the thing is with deodorants now is like no one's going to eat them. So, they're now the latest is that they're all permissible. And I don't know what the latest is on mouthwashes. Are all mouthwashes permissible now? Because I remembered a few years ago, it was only the certain Listerines that were permissible.
Interesting. Well, I figured because it had to do with like the alcohol that's in there,
Right.
and I mean, they have to be certified for Pesach because it has to probably be a certain type of alcohol that's or non-alcoholic, non-alcoholic mouthwash. Because I
Well,
remember.
I still have all the Listerine mouthwashes that, were certified okay for, were okay for Pesach. And the toothpaste, the Crest, like regular Crest toothpaste is okay, but I need to use what's called the gum detoxify.
Gum detoxify, what's that?
Yeah, it's a special toothpaste for gum care.
Interesting.
Because as you get older, your gums start to recede.
Oh, my ointment. I because I remember as a kid, besides the spaceship, in the kitchen and things like that,
I remember,
definitely.
yes,
Yeah, definitely there was
the
like
walls and everything were literally plastered with silver foil. And remember having to stick the tape on them to try to get them to stay to the walls. And then I remember the refrigerator, they had this thing where you had to put silver, you had to line the walls and the shelves of the refrigerator with silver foil. And the problem was if you clean the refrigerator, that the walls of the refrigerator are wet. So I had to take a blow dryer and dry the walls of the refrigerator so the masking tape would stick with the silver foil. And to line the refrigerator took me as long as cleaning the refrigerator itself.
Yeah, I mean, I remember as a kid just doing all the cleaning and not me like I would do everything else with everybody, of course. And we would clean the books, and we would have like all a whole giant pile. I remember as a young kid feeling like cleaning the van would take so long. But when I got older, I figured out a way to like just clean the whole entire van like in like under an hour. You take out the cushions and you just the chairs and you just go ahead and vacuum everything. And sometimes I
The
think
problem is taking out the chairs, putting them back in, and bolting them down.
no, it wasn't that big of a deal.
No.
No, it wasn't a problem at all.
Man, what? Maybe for you as a man it isn't, but for me as a woman, it was hard getting out those cushions, getting out those chairs, trying to carry them out.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't. It really wasn't. Like for me, it wasn't an issue. I think it was like 15 when I started cleaning the van, and I just because I still remember as a kid, like, you know, the amount of, you know, stringency based off like when I was younger versus today is just like it's not like a total opposite, but like I'm definitely I don't kill myself as much as I did when I was younger. And I remember Pesci one year got really into the whole concept of not using any what's it called? It's not using any processed foods or processed anything. And she made her own ketchup and did all the stuff. And some people like get really into it where they make like everything they pre-make, where they got to make their own gefilte fish, they make their own lemon juice, they make their own grape juice, they make their own wine. Like everything is just pre-made, which is really,
Some
really cool.
people also have this thing where they will take sugar and boil it up and filter it. So for sugar, you're drinking this liquid, you know, sugar. Like when you need sugar, you've got this like liquid stuff it's like very syrupy that you would pour into your coffee or your tea. And as the week went on, these crystals, like rock candy, would start to form around the edge of the container. And I remember in Crown Heights, how kids would break it off and eat it for candy. Yeah, I know that. I know a lot of people, a lot of very free from people who will not eat anything processed during Pesach.
It's very interesting. It's just as interesting as realizing Maxwell House, the coffee maker, makes a Haggadah every year, and they've been doing it since like the 1950s.
You're talking about what, Maxwell House?
Yeah.
Tried the 1930s. When
Really?
I was a kid, we had a Haggadah from Maxwell House from like 1934 in my
Interesting.
house. A little one, like a little pot. He's like small Haggadahs.
Yeah, so apparently it was a marketing promotion in 1932, and it's been going strong ever since. It's the funniest thing because it's just like it's a coffee company, and they make this stuff.
Well, you know their slogan, good to the very last drop. You know who coined that? You wouldn't believe it. It was Theodore Roosevelt.
Really?
Yeah, he liked Maxwell House coffee. And one time he said something about it being good to the very last drop, and they took that on as their regular slogan.
That's really cute. Yeah, it's just I that's where it's just like I always find it interesting when you have, you know, different media that surprisingly mentions like Jewish culture or, you know, Pesach. Like the famous one is the Rugrats Haggadah, the Rugrats
I've never
Passover.
heard of this.
Oh yeah, oh my God,
That
this is
is cute. When was this?
This was in the 90s.
What? Well, but the creators of Rugrats, Jewish? Who created Rugrats?
I could do quick I could quickly check, but yeah, it was called a Rugrats Passover, and it came out in April 13th, 1995.
Was it a book
No,
or was it a gun?
I think it was a movie. I think it was an episode. I think it was an episode in the Rugrats TV show.
Oh, that is cute.
Yeah.
You
And
remember watching it as a kid?
yeah, I do remember watching it as a kid. It was a lot
What
of
was it
fun.
like?
It's
Like, was it
funny.
really kosher? Is something that a front kid could watch if he's fairly kosher?
Oh, yeah, it was definitely kosher for a kid to watch. I mean, you know, as you know, for our family, it would be. Other families, they wouldn't. But it was something where it was like, I don't know, I enjoyed it. You feel like this connection. You feel like, you know, you're seen, you're heard, especially as a little kid. Of course, you also get to point out all the flaws in something, or you know, something gets, you know, something's off, or they missaid something, or the pronunciation was a little different. But you know, it's also like, you know, watching when I was a kid watching The Simpsons, and they'd have Krusty the Clown, who was Jewish. He would have like, you know, other like Jewish jokes in there and things like that. Do you remember seeing that as a kid? Any like slight winks and nods to Judaism, watching TV
I
shows or
remember
reading books?
Three Stooges would would put in Yiddish phrases every now and then in their in their movies. I think we told you that one time about when they were pharmacists, the episode where they were pharmacists, they were putting together the formula for eternal youth. And one of the ingredients was mishigas they used. And I remember one where Mo was on this golf course, and this Italian golf course, he was doing something on the golf course to ruin the turf there. And of course, this Italian groundskeeper runs over and starts yelling at him in Italian. And Mo says, hack mine China, hack mine China.
It was interesting. Speaking of, you said a Jewish and Italian, I was thinking of Jewish mobsters. I was watching this video from JLI, the Jewish Learning Institute, and they had a like interview with a Jewish mobster and just had him talk for like 12 minutes about
his. Was he incognito?
No, he wasn't incognito. He was an ex-mobster. He was done with all this stuff. I'm trying to think of his name. I think it was, hold on, let me just quickly check. Myron Sugarman.
Interesting.
Wow. He has a book called The Last Jewish Gangster.
When was he gangster?
I mean, he is 86 years old, so you can do the math. You know, you can do a quick calculation. It's we're in 2024 minus 86. So he came out, he was born 1938, so probably like the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
Most likely. You know, 60s, 70s. He probably, you know, did, I don't know if he did his time or was able to get out of it legally and whatnot.
Was he white collar or violent?
The video, you definitely get the impression he was violent. Because he's like, yeah, and I spoke to her and I have a ways of persuasion and eventually she listened to me. I'm like, oh, wow, okay. All right, this guy's definitely nonsense.
There was one in that book that Yehuda Leib, your brother.
But they were good to their mothers?
Yeah, the one, but he was good to his mother, right? There was one Orthodox, he was a killer. What do they call them?
Oh, a hitman.
A hitman, he was a hitman. He was Shomer Shabbos. He would never kill anybody on Shabbos.
Yeah, because the book is called But He Was Good to His Mother by Robert A. Rockaway.
Yeah.
And I started reading it when I was younger. I was in someone's house and I started reading it. I liked it, but I never got around to finishing it. But it was...
Well, why is it that we are, though, so entertained in a way by these... I don't know. It's like we find something entertaining about criminals, like, you know, Jesse James and... Al Capone and Bugsy Siegel and all these, you know, there's something about these bad guys that we find entertaining, and we shouldn't. They're doing something wrong.
Well, I think
it's we romanticize them and we entertain them, make up songs about them, enjoy reading about them. What is it?
I think it's a reflection on the human condition. If you think about it, it's such a reflection of like what you wish you had the guts to do sometimes. They're like a no nonsense, I don't care, I'm gonna get stuff done. You're like, yeah, there it is. That's what's going on. Like I think that was like a whole issue post 9/11 era of like they had this TV show called 24 with Jack Bauer, and the whole point was he's trying to stop these terrorists and he can't because of all the red tape that the government gives. So he like, you know, he goes against the grain and he disobeys orders, but he gets the results. And it's that whole concept of feeding into like, oh, only if you broke the rules and was violent, you would get what you wanted, which is funny because they found a statistics that that's actually not true when it comes to, you know, working somebody and getting information out of them. You know, violence doesn't really help. It's actually, you know, not, I would say bribing, but having this condition of tit for tat, you know, helping, I help you, you help me kind of situation. And then we could figure out, you know, a common ground. Which tends to be the main way of obtaining information nowadays, instead of the whole violent, like, I'll tell you, show you what's up, blah, 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 blah.
Well, I remember my father telling me during World War II, in fact, there was a movie that was made about it, where there was this one of the big guys in Hitler's government, one of his main interrogators, found that he got more information by bringing captured American soldiers to like a nice resort and giving them nice food and wine and sitting and just talking to them very casually. He got much more information that way rather than, you know, torturing. And then I went on YouTube, I was scrolling through YouTube, and yeah, what my father told me was true. Evidently there's a YouTube spot about this German interrogator using that, you know, use this technique.
Yeah, his name is Hans Scharf. He was a German Luftwaffe interrogator during the Second World War. And he died in California in 1992 at the age of 84.
Wow.
And like, it's honestly, it's more, I think, more intimidating when someone is softer and quieter and shows kindness than violence, because violence, you know, they're wearing it on their sleeve. You know who they are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if somebody was, you know, you, yeah, like the Scharf was opposed to physically abusing prisoners to obtain information. And learning on the job, he insisted he relied upon the Luftwaffe's approved list of techniques, mostly making the interrogator seem like his prisoner's greatest advocate while in captivity. Scharf described various experiences with new POWs, outlining the procedure of his fellow interrogators were instructed to use. Yeah, so this guy was a very calm, relaxed, and caring individual. At least that's what he presented to the POWs, and that's how he'd get information.
I've seen that sometimes when you look at some of these detective, like the True Life detective spots on YouTube.
Yeah.
And a lot of times they'll show films, they'll show recordings of the police interrogating somebody. And some of the policemen, a lot of the policemen actually, would sit and just talk. You want a cigarette, you want this, you want that, you want a drink. And they would sit very casually and talk to the person. And like you said, present themselves to the criminal as like, you know, the good cop, like, you know, kind of like we're in this together and I want to help you. And if you'll, you know, type like, also when people relax, they, you know, they reveal more when they're more relaxed, they let their guard down. And in just casual conversation, they can give all sorts of hints as to whether or not they're guilty.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, did you ever do any of those tactics when you were a teacher in school?
Trying to think.
Because school's kind of like prison and war. I mean, in the general sense of like the, well, like
I
the...
had a situation once where I was hired as a nanny, mm-hmm. and all the kids were home. And the parents, I think the mother was either teaching, or I think the mother actually was in the hospital having a baby, you know, so I was in charge of the house for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the boys got into a fight with his younger brother and he locked him in a room. And the poor kid, little kid, like 6 years old, was banging at the door, banging the older one to let him out. And I didn't want to get into any type of, and the older one refused to let him out. And to get into a physical confrontation as a caretaker is the worst thing you can do. Worst thing. So I came over to the boy and I said, look, I said, I'm concerned for you. I said, you know, if your parents come home and find out what happened, how you locked your younger brother in the room, wouldn't let him out, I said, they're going to be very angry and there's probably going to be some punishment involved. And I don't want to see that happen to you. I want you to, you know, I don't want to see you get punished like that. And he said, okay. And he let the kid out.
Interesting. What about when you were raising us? Did you like, because I know you probably developed a different sense of discipline with like the youngest versus the oldest.
Oh, for sure.
Did it basically go from like, trying to be intense and controlling versus like just pick your battles and when you have the chance, explain what's going on?
Absolutely. You did. You know, being a parent is no different from any other job or career. You start on your career, you come out of high school or college, you take on this job or this, you know, this career or this trade, And as the years go by, you find better techniques. No one comes into a job knowing everything and being perfect and being absolutely totally excellent from the very beginning. It's a bumpy road. You learn better techniques as you go along. You learn certain things that you were doing took up too much money and time, and here's a good way to cut corners and get better results. And the same thing too is as a parent. You come in, yes, you're right. When you first start out as a parent, you are nervous. You've never done this before, let's face it. And a lot of times you fall back on the way you were raised and what you saw in your own house, which can sometimes was good, sometimes was not the best, especially my generation. We were raised by the
silent generation.
We went over that a few times,
Yeah, we've talked about that.
Spare the rod and spoil the child. By the way, Shlomo HaMelech said that.
Interesting.
Spare the rod and spoil the child. You ever hear about the Medrash about how Batsheva would discipline Shlomo HaMelech when he was a kid?
No.
It would have gotten her arrested by Child Protective Services. She would tie him to a pole, take off her slipper, and beat him with it.
Oh. Wow. That's intense.
Yeah. In fact, it was a joke in my generation about, our parents as they were beating us saying, "I'm only doing this for your own good." I'm doing this because I love you. Really? Me and my friends used to laugh about that. Oh, yeah, right.
Well, that's,
So, like with your older sister, your firstborn, with your older sister, the firstborn girl, yes, I smacked her too much. I really did. I should have used other techniques. I find by the way, where I'm working, in the preschool, that I've seen a lot of these teachers have been going to workshops, and it's, wow, these workshops are really very, very good. Like, I notice their techniques are fantastic. Like, you'll have a kid that'll all of a sudden turn around and hit another child. And mm-hmm. So right away, they take this child away. They sit him down. And they said, "I see something is upsetting you. What is it?" And they would say whatever was upsetting them. They would say, "Okay, but you must use your words. You cannot use your hands." And like, they calm the kid down and show him that him or her that, just tell us what is bothering you. And most of the time they get into fights over toys. So I will come over and I'll take the kid that's hit the other one. And they'll say they want the other toy. And I said, "Yeah, but he had it first. And that's not fair. Now, let's you and I pick out another one to get another toy together. There are other toys. We can pick that out." Your father had a great technique with your kids fighting over toys. He would go to the first child and say, who had it first? "You have it for 10 minutes. I'll put on the timer." And he would turn to the kid who wanted the toy and said, "And then you'll have it for the next 10 minutes," which I thought was a really good technique.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of remember when I was a kid I actually remember this from preschool. Some kid was sitting in my seat. So I told him to get out of my seat. He said no. I pushed him. I sat back in my seat. And then you told me after I got home and got in trouble that just because someone's in my seat doesn't mean I have to push them away. You can ask them nicely. If not, you'll go find another seat.
Right.
And mm-hmm. I thought to myself, that's the most pussy ass bitch thing to say. Someone's in your spot, you kick him out because he's in your spot. And that's my thought when I was a kid. And as I got older, I was right. I think it's ridiculous. But you just don't want to deal with conflict, and you can't necessarily deal with conflict nowadays as pushing someone out because someone's in your spot. You have to find another softer approach
You can't get violent.
You can't get violent. That's really what it is. Yeah. You can't get violent.
Yeah, because you're going to get arrested. Yeah, you're going to get a lot of trouble being violent. Well, I was an assistant in a class of 2-year-olds, and I saw this kid. He was amazing. Some kid did that, got in a seat. And he just said, "Get out of this is my seat." And the boy said no. And he goes, "Okay," and just went and got another chair. And sat. In fact, he put the other chair right next to the kid that was in his seat, sat right next to him.
And he was known as a pushover for the rest of the world.
For a 2-year-old? It was a 2-year-old boy.
Yeah, that's very good.
That's pretty mature for a 2-year-old boy.
Well, because I was thinking, because it happened to me last week. Someone was sitting in my spot in shul, So I just, you know, I sat right next to him and I told him, you know, you could sit here. You know, I just need to sit near my Makam Kavua. And he understood. He was like, oh, I'm so sorry. And he got up and he left. But that's also dealing with adults. With kids, it's different story. If two kids, you know, it's like freaking, it's like the Amazon. Like you got to really, you know, in some way fight.
Survival of the fittest.
I think I remember talking to you about this as well, mentioning it to you a couple of times, either on air or off air.
Well, there was one with the, when the Rebbe would give up ringings. You there was a big crush. I mean, it was a very big crowd, especially around Yom Tov time.
Yeah.
And I saw some, like some men get in the fights.
Oh yeah.
That wanted to get closer to where the Rebbe was. And even in the women's section, we had some women who, especially like some of the, I hate to say it, some of the foreign women, especially
Frenchies,
some of the French. Hate to say it. Yes, hate to say it. We had some French women that, well, they were only there for a little while.
It doesn't matter.
You know, this was their once in a lifetime chance.
That's great.
But, you know, but and they got very physical. But there was this one time I was right in the front row and I was listening to a Fabringen, and there was this young woman, you know, we were young girls, we were like early 20s, and she kept pushing me and pushing me and pushing me. So I thought to myself, do I get nasty and tell her to stop pushing me and yell at her? Or I had an idea. I said, you know, I see you're very anxious to want to get close to see the Rebbe here. You can have my spot. I thought that'd be nice. Yeah, I'll be nice to her. And she thanked me so much. She goes, thank you so very, very much. She goes, I just flew in from Australia. I will never get a chance to see the Rebbe again. I'm flying out tomorrow. And this is my only chance. Thank you so very, very much.
That she punched you in the face and then ran away.
No, she didn't.
Yeah, she did. Nice. I know. Nice. I'm just being annoying.
Well, there was this one woman though.
Yeah.
Who, an Israeli woman, who this girl was standing up on the bleachers to see the Rebbe. This woman comes up behind her and yells at her, get down, you're in my spot, and started actually punching her.
Yeah.
And this girl turns around and she says, stop punching me. You weren't here, but you know, no one was here before. I'm here. And the woman was really using her fist. I took my arms. I grabbed this woman from the top and I put her in a hole. And she was a lot thinner than me and weaker. And she kept trying to wiggle out. And the more she wiggled out, the more I tightened my hold. Mm-hmm. And she yells at me, let me go, let me go, let me go. I said to her, I'll let you go on one condition. She goes, what? I said, you promised to walk out of here.
Oh, wow.
And she did. Because yeah. I'm sorry, that was the way she acted was totally, totally out of line. In fact, there was one time where the head of Beis Rivka wanted to appoint some girls that she thought were strong girls to keep order in the women's section. I got appointed. So there was this Fabringen where it was a crunch crowd. And it was like pandemonium. And no matter what I said or did, nobody was listening to me. So the head of the school comes into the women's section. She looks at me and she goes, no, you were supposed to keep order. I go, stop. I'm sorry. It's like this.
Oh, you tried. Yeah, I was thinking when I was younger, when I was in 770, I had a great time, like Yom Kippur and Simchas Torah. It was just very aggressive. But I never dealt with, I've heard stories, but never dealt with people that were you know, pushing and shoving and punching to get to either get to a certain location or whatnot. Like I even remember going to not Mesh Arim, Meron, going to Meron for Lag BaOmer, and that place got crowded. Like I at one point was like, I jumped, and then like I was stuck between two guys. My feet didn't touch the floor. It was so crowded. It was so crowded, and it was great. I loved it. It was a lot of fun. But I never. I mean, I think the only issue I had was like, just going, trying to get onto the buses after Lag BaOmer and Meron. It definitely was like a lot of pushing and shoving, you know, and but that's, I think that's just Israeli, you know, mentality of like trying to get somewhere and just push it. Like I've seen videos of Japanese subways, Japanese trains, or Chinese trains. I'm not sure if it's Japanese or Chinese, but like
Japanese. They a number of years ago, they instituted male and female trains in Japan, in Tokyo.
Really?
Because the women were complaining about groping.
Interesting.
In crowded trains, and so they designated male and female trains. Yeah.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I've seen videos of it like years ago. I don't know if it's still now, but so crowded that you had this conductor with white gloves who would come to the door, and before they closed the doors, would actually, with white gloves, push people in, and then they could close the doors.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about. I was talking about that push. Yeah. So it's just like, it's different culture. I think America has like a little bit of like a personal space, respectful culture of like, we're not going to push, we're not going to move, we're just going to stand and like wait. And if we can get somewhere, we can get somewhere. I think a lot of Middle Eastern and other like Asian cultures, it's more of like, well, there's a space there, go into that space. Like, it's fine.
Well, I remember when I was in Israel for the first time in 73, going on the bus, and oh my God, the people elbowing me and pushing me back. And then at first I'm like, what's going on here? And then eventually I acclimated myself and I started pushing through to get on the bus.
You know what's funny about that? So I went to Israel like multiple times. I went from 06 to 08. I went in 2000, I think 11 or 12. And then I went again in 2017. When I went into 2017, I was used to like old school Israeli mentality. So I was like, there was like a big crowd going towards the Kotel. So I'm like, okay, I'll push, I'll shove, I'll move. Mm-hmm. And I start doing that. And someone looked at me like, stop pushing, stop shoving. I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize that wasn't okay nowadays. So like the mentality has changed and shifted.
I think it's become Americanized.
Maybe.
Because of the influx of American immigrants.
Yeah, because like, I wasn't expecting. I see a bunch of people and like I'm itching a little closer and I'm trying to like avoid somebody and trying to like move a little more to the side and trying to get going, and they're like, stop, calm down, just walk.
I don't want to repeat my stories again, but did I tell the story that the neighbor of mine whose parents came from Israel, and she asked me to take them?
Yes,
to the
we
store.
Talked about that. Okay, we won't bring that up. It's fine. We've already covered that. We're trying to find new things to talk about.
I was thinking about something, totally changed the subject.
Sure.
Raising children. I remember Yosef, when he was like 8 years old, would get a big kick out of when I would put him to bed at night after I left the room. He got a big kick out of scaring Menachem by telling him all sorts of scary stories about monsters. And of course, you know, Menachem at the time being 4 years old, you know, would get scared. So I came into the room. I said, no, you know, I calmed them down, say, you know, it's not nice and scary, brother. So then one time I left the room, and all of a sudden I hear Yosef, Ema, come back, come back. I said, what's the matter? He goes, hold me. I said, what's the matter, Yosef? He says, I scared myself. He was telling Menachem this scary story about monsters, and he scared himself with his own story.
I think I remember that when that happened. He was talking about, he was like, because we saw the movie It. With Stephen King, movie. It was like a TV show movie with It, with Stephen King, and like he started copying its like famous sayings of like, we all float down here and things like that, and it got to a point where that's when he started scaring himself, because he started like trying to imitate him. I think at one point, Menachem got shoved into like the downstairs bathroom closet, and Yosef locked it and started talking like stuff like a clown and whatnot, and really was got on Malcolm's case. Like it wasn't a fun little situation.
I remember my mother telling me that at nighttime, when her parents would put them to bed with her older sister, and her older sister, this is like the 1920s, her older sister, like I think was just 2 years older than she was, and she would tell them about the little man that comes down from the ceiling that is going to kill you or something. And my mother would start screaming and crying, and her parents would come into the room and, you know, get mad. Well, the parents being Polish, you know, Polish discipline, bang, bang, you know, be quiet, go to sleep, smack, smack, you know, type thing. And then I remember when I was a kid, siblings love to scare each other for some reason like that.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think if I ever did anything to, oh, don't ask some of the, your Aunt Judy is lucky she's alive, some of the stuff I did to her as a kid.
Like what?
Oh my God. Plastic bags had just come out.
Okay.
In the mid-1950s. And a lot of people, it took a while, new technology before people realized how dangerous they were.
Mm-hmm.
There were women who thought this would be a great way to cover their babies in their crib, to put it over the cribs, to keep the babies away from flies or whatever, not knowing how dangerous that was. And finally, they had to put advertisements, like public service advertisements on television showing exactly, don't do this with a plastic bag, don't do that, don't use it to cover a baby carriage, don't use it to put it over your baby crib, keep it away from children, don't put it over anyone's head. They had to actually, educate the public. So one time I took a clear plastic bag and I said, let's play Spaceman. I put it over Aunt Judy's face and I go, go, and fortunately I said to her, go show mommy. Thank God I said that.
Wow.
Go show mommy that you're a spaceman. And she ran over to my mother and she goes, look, I'm a spaceman. And my mother went, let out a scream and grabbed the plastic bag and ripped it off her face and then, yelled at me and started to tell me how dangerous that was. And I didn't realize that she told me that Aunt Judy's face at that point was turning purple.
Whoa.
And we didn't know, kids didn't know.
No, kids don't know.
And then there was one time we were playing in the pool and I picked up Aunt Judy, was like maybe 3 or 4 years old, and I just threw her right into the pool. And my mother at first thought we'd thrown a ball into the pool and then realized, no, that we'd thrown our baby sister into the pool, and she ran out and grabbed her out.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I think I don't know if we talked about it, but we were talking about the, I guess with Yehuda, with he saw some movie or TV show of a guy breaking a belt with when it's wrapped around his neck. And he tried doing that when he was younger, and it just basically made his whole like face blue.
He ran into the kitchen like that. He was, he couldn't breathe, and I very quickly, thank God, I was able to, rip off the belt very quickly.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I'm trying to think of anything else. I remember as a kid, I would make these like forts. And at one point I put a whole like bunch of thick blankets over me, thinking like, oh, it could be protect me. And I realized like I started slowly losing oxygen. I'm like, boy, I can't breathe. And luckily I was able to like move everything out and I was fine. But I don't remember anything specific. I did. But it just, I mean, I guess that's just how it is as a kid. You're just constantly screwing up and acting like an idiot, and just hopefully the adults, take care of you. It's like, I think somebody compared it to, taking care of a kid is like taking care of your friend that's on mushrooms, and like you've taken just the right amount, but like, they've taken a little too much, and you just got to make sure that licking a toaster isn't the best idea. So it's just
that's why kids, your father would come home, how come the house is a mess? I mm-hmm. said, I'm watching the kids.
Yeah.
Let's face it, you've got kids playing whatever, you've got to be right there watching them. You don't know what they're gonna do.
Yeah. I mean, like right now, it's like my house is just, luckily Ruthie is watching the kid and everything is fine. But yeah, it's like you can't expect anything else. Just take it one day at a time, one step at a time. If something needs to be cleaned up now, it'll be cleaned up now.
It's like you can't turn your back for it. These kids move so fast, you can't turn your back for a second.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's
you gotta be so careful.
Second, Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Gosh. Okay, Mom. I'll talk to you later.
Okay, stay safe out there, people.
Stay safe. Be cool. Stay in school.
Watch your kids. Stay safe.
Exactly. Watch your kids. Stay safe. Make sure there's no plastic bags over their heads.
Especially Pesach vacation coming up, Chalamoy trips.
Oh, yeah, Chalamoy trips. That's always fun. Alrighty, I'll talk to you later.
Love you, honey.
Love you. Have a good Shabbos.
Have a good Shabbos. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Jewish Boy Calls His Mother. Please comment and subscribe on our Facebook page, YouTube channel, and Instagram. I would greatly appreciate it, and my mother would too.